Well, today on the Kenai Conversation, we're going to talk about commercial salmon fishing. This show isn't a debate about commercial fishing versus sport fishing, not dip netting or kite flying. It's about commercial salmon fishing, what the season was like, what might be done, ideas. We're not going to solve the world's problems here today. Let's see. I'll do away with the music here. We have in the studio Paul Shadura, Jesse Bjorkman, and on the phone we have Andy Hall. Andy, do I got you there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, excellent. Can everybody hear Andy?
Yeah, Jay, we got him.
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, I came up with this idea for this show after attending the Friday session with Governor Bill Walker that they had out at the Aquaculture Center that you guys were all at, and a lot of the information there struck me as information that is not out in the general public. In fact, I posted a story about that, and it was about the dip netting, I guess. And you know, there's a perception, I think, in the general public that commercial fishermen are the evil people around here. And, I know that not to be true, only because, I know commercial fishermen. I'm from a commercial fishing town, and, I just want some facts to get out. So I thought this would be a good venue to talk about the season, talk about escapement policy, which, thank you, Jesse, you cleared me up on that yesterday.
Well, you're welcome, Jay.
Yeah. Where should we start? This is a good question. Does anybody have anything they want to start with talking about the Cook Inlet salmon season? Any of them? Not all at once.
This is Andy. I guess I'm hearing a lot of silence. So, if you want to talk just about the season, I'd think this is about, if not the worst in recent history, probably 2012 was the worst when we didn't, we virtually had no fishing. And then it turned out that decision was based on flawed information and that we were pulled out of the water because there was a perception or an inability to count by Fish and Game of the kings going into the river. And then later in the year, which is not widely known to my surprise, the department came out and said we almost over-escaped kings. They just weren't able to count them. So that was the worst. That impacted hundreds of fishing families, probably as many or more people who make money off of fishing, meaning truck drivers, processors, fuel sales, motor, outboard sales, everything that you can think of that revolves around commercial fishing. In addition, a federal disaster was declared, and people both in the, and Paul should jump in if I'm wrong on any of this, but people in the fishing, commercial fishing community, as well as the sport fishing community, received some of those federal disaster funds. So it was a costly mistake. It was not paid for by the state. It was paid for by fishermen, by sport fishermen, and by the federal government. And then this, in the years since, it hasn't been great. I mean, they've been marginally worse every year, at least from my perspective. And then this year is probably a third or two-thirds as the last poor season. So, from a just purely financial perspective, it's been pretty devastating to the at least the set netting community. I'm a set netter, so, on the other hand, people have been set netting on this inlet for something, in one way or another, for almost a century, and we want that to continue. And, regardless of the rhetoric you're hearing, I've never heard a fisherman in any type of fishing, commercial fishing or sport fishing, frankly, who wants to fish these fish into the ground. Nobody wants to fish if the run you know, if our activity is going to kill this fishery, as you know, some I hear people saying sometimes, we, you know, we're the people who, you know, have been there the longest, and we want this sustainable fishery to continue. So I'm going to stop now because I don't want to ramble. I'm going to give somebody else a chance.
Paul?
Yeah, thank you, Jay. Probably to continue on with some of the things Andy said, the 2012 was considered an economic disaster. The closures were, you know, when you look at it after the season, weren't warranted, and it did affect a large base of the user groups, and therefore it was an economic disaster based on that. This situation we look at is more of a biological disaster concern and affecting several areas of the state. Probably the thing to consider the most in my mind is that even the preseason forecast indicated a less return of sockeye than the previous year. And, you know, at this point, at 450,000 kenai sockeyes past the sonar, we're looking at about a halfway mark to what the optimal escapement goal is. And I think it's people should be aware that the optimal escapement goal is one that takes into consideration social issues and less based on pure science or what we can bring back for the most benefit on a continuous basis. That's called maximum sustained yield. That's a scientific assessment based on long-term valuations of previous returns and patterns and age classes and a lot of other technical knowledge. So the biological escapement goal, the sustainable escapement goal at this point, is 700,000 for the Kenai River. And then you need to consider what's harvested or captured above the sonar. So I think 900 seems like a large goal at this point at 450. I think it's quite reasonable to consider by the 24th of August, as of last year, that's how long the Department of Fish and Game kept the sonar in, that we will reach that sustainable escapement goal. Probably a little, if I could just finish with this little part here, is that last year there was 600,000 sockeyes through August 24th in the Kenai River that came in after July 30th, thereabout. I could be wrong a couple days here, but that's a considerably large amount of return, and a final of 1.35 million. Continual returns in the high range stresses the system, stresses the rearing abilities, the food capabilities, the competition factor in Skelak Lake. And so, you know, if the department continually estimates a return diminishing in the Kenai River, and then you couple it with biological high seas conditions that none of us are very sure about, but obviously has affected fisheries up and down the West Coast and in Alaska this year. Clearly, those stressors at the same time create runs like this, erratic returns. And I'll leave it at that and continue later.
Okay. Jesse, did you want to say something to start off here?
Thanks, Jay.
Yeah,
I wanted to make sure that as we talk about our fisheries being the set net fishery that Andy and Paul are here representing today, and the gillnet fishery, the drift gillnet fishery, as well as the in-river users as well, that we all take into account that, as Paul said, we're all in this together, and we all deeply care about these fish and want to make sure that these fish are managed in a way that they are going to be sustainable for generations of Alaskans to come. And so I think that's important for everybody to to recognize. And my concern with the process this year of management and the management plan is, are we taking into consideration all of the institutional knowledge that the department has about what does maximum sustained yield look like for the Kenai River system and Upper Cook Inlet in general, and what does that mean for residents here on the Kenai Peninsula? What does that mean for their fishing opportunity as well as their economic opportunity here on the peninsula? So I think that's important to recognize that, you know, as fishermen using the resource, you know, I guess I could consider myself maybe a super user because I really love commercial fishing and I really enjoy sport fishing, and I've engaged in the personal use fishery as well. So I have some understanding of all of those fisheries. What does it mean? What's at stake here? I think that's the first question we need to answer. And then why is it important for all of these fisheries to be able to function properly and in a good way that can meet the needs of all Alaskans?
Yeah, that's a great goal, I think, that everyone has. Where does it fall apart, in your opinion, trying to achieve that kind of goal?
I think the biggest thing that stands in the way of achieving that goal is misinformation and intentional misinformation that's put into the public by some special interests that seem to only act in their own best interests and not in the best interests of all Alaskans. And it's really unfortunate when we have user groups that, in my opinion, really blatantly misrepresent the facts in order to further their own cause. And that's really unfortunate, and it's too bad. It's not good for Alaskans, and it's not good for the fish.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that.
Uh-huh. What can be done about this? Do you guys have a rapid response fact-checking like they got now for presidential debates or anything?
This is Andy. We had an incident earlier this year where a prominent Kenai River sport fishing group presented numbers to a number of media outlets saying that set netters had taken 1,700 large kings, where the information was easily, it was wrong. It wasn't what the department said, but it was put out there, and as a group, KPFA, the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association, which is represents set netters in Cook Inlet, we put out a rather pointed press release clarifying that the numbers were wrong, and we put a number in it, but we said we called on the department to release that information. When the department went to the large king goal, they started counting only large kings. We were concerned that they were going to report those large kings in the river, but they were still counting every king that a set net catches and not differentiating them. And they were not, at the time, were not willing to break that count out. We said we could do it on fish tickets. The canneries already do it because you don't get as, you know, you're paid less for small jack kings. So we put this press release out and said the department is the only source of information that is, you know, in that is irrefutable. I mean, people are still going to refute what they say, but they're not biased. They're not representing a group, because I don't believe what that other group says just because it's them saying it. And I'm sure people feel the same way if KPFA came out and said, hey, the number's wrong. So I asked the department to provide that information, and they did. And now when you call in to hear the fishery, I can't think of what the number, the call is, we call it the number, but we call it every day to find out if we're going to fish. He reports the catch of large kings in the set net fishery. There was going to be a larger effort to put that information out into the general public. I've been too busy fishing to really pay attention to what's going on beyond that. But I think the department has to provide that data, because if anybody else provides it, it's going to be questioned. But you know, by the people who vilify commercial fishermen, or the people who vilify sport fishing, or guides, or whatever. So somebody, They have the information. They've got to put it out there. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
Yeah, thank you, Andy. I think that was a very important point about having the department as an unbiased agency, managing agency, to get information out in a timely manner and in the most complete and manner that they can. I think there's another thing I'd like to talk about. It's something that I frequently say. When we come to access to our resources in our state, we have a fairly strong constitution that gives us access, all of us. So in that aspect, first you have to consider a reasonable opportunity to access any resource in the state, and particularly this one. And then you have to have, after that, a realistic expectation. I think in many ways, some of the user groups are not sharing in the burden of conservation in somewhat of an equitable manner. That's a discussion constantly at the Board of Fish, I know. But this year, you know, the PU fishery continued while the commercial fisheries were shut down for conservation concerns. And there wasn't appearing, at least at the governor's meeting, there didn't appear to be any mechanisms of which the department could actively use to reduce some of those unrealistic opportunities or unrealistic expectations when we had concerns of meeting the minimum escapement goals in the Kenai River. And in that aspect, I heard different commenters and some that weren't fisheries, commercial fisheries related at all, saying, you know, that is an issue that should be looked at. At the end, the commissioner closed the PU fisheries for 2 days and reduced the bag and possession limit for sockeye in the Kenai River. I was asking for what kind of savings that was or how that was going to help, and I couldn't get a definitive answer. So in many ways, I think that management should have more authorities to do things in season. They're creative. The Board of Fish has said many times to the Department of Fish and Game, bring us some plans, bring us some solutions that will help you to better balance the situation and to maintain the goals. Another point I'd like to bring up is what's called lost opportunities. Right now we're sitting at about 300,000 in the Kasiloff River. Its top end of his escapement is 340, but there's another optimal escapement goal, not unlike the Kenai, that says that to meet the minimum goal in the Kenai, you can exceed the top end of the Kasiloff River up to 390,000. That's 50,000 more fish in a rather small system that is above its top maximum sustained yield range. And when we consider that, we're closing this fishery down. We thought the department felt that there wasn't enough kings, and now we have 9,500. Clearly, we'll make the 13.5 large king goal, which, I mind you, is a new goal and an arbitrary point. And for commercial fishermen, there's other harvestable surplus stocks out in the inlet that they'd like to have access to. And we understand the department has ways and the commissioner has authority to manage methods and means, time and area, and such to tamp down our capacities or our capabilities, but allow us some kind of access to these resources. As I expressed to the governor on that Friday meeting, we are looking in the long range for some kind of disaster relief or some relief from the state to help us with our loans to the state for vessels and permits and such. But the long-term goal is always the solution is most fishers would rather be fishing in some capacity. That is the solution for economic relief. So somehow I feel personally the system is unbalanced here, and that the department needs more abilities to be able to flex in season. And these optimum escapement goals, which are mandated by the Board of Fish and their statements that they have just released, I guess, as we hear on our fishing report, keep telling us that that's the way it has to be. But in actuality, the only person or only agency that's authorized by the state constitution is the Department of Fish and Game for Sustainability, Economic Opportunities, and Conservation.
You know, I was surprised Friday when the commissioner told the there was one gentleman sitting in the front row, and he said that he had been involved in a Supreme Court case against the Fish and Game, apparently, about these sort of things, emergency order authority. And he said, no, I don't have that kind of authority. And it surprised me that either he doesn't think he has that authority or that he does not have that authority. You would think he would be able to do some of these things that you're talking about.
Well, in fact, I was part of that case, and we had taken two cases, as a matter of fact, questioning the OEG on the Kosilof River, and at the same time, the seemingly control of the commissioner's authority to do in-season management. And to those that don't know what in-season management, it is the hallmark of the Alaska Fisheries Program. That is that what happens in season, the commissioner and the department has the abilities to react in a real-time basis rather than a static way to manage like the council, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council or National Marine Fisheries Service manages our high seas fisheries. Or the way that the federal government managed our state fisheries prior to statehood. In other words, after the fact, months later, then the agency, the governing agency or managing agency, would then regulate changes. Well, it's kind of like how sport fish operates now in the state of Alaska, with very little in-season management and more reaction after the fact. So as it comes to the emergency order authority, every single plan, management plan in Cook Inlet, at the end of those plans, has a paragraph or two that talks about that nothing in these plans will supersede the authority of the commissioner and his ability to implement orders for in orderly fisheries or conservation or development in season. That's clear. The courts agreed to it. And also the state of Alaska did not contest that. They also agreed to it.
Wow. Man. Jesse, you've been quiet over here. You getting questions from the ether there on your phone?
No. No, I'm not. But, yeah, it's interesting. You know, Andy and Paul both have a lot more experience in the inlet than I do. And Paul being active on our local AC certainly has experience on in that vein and trying to craft a message locally to the Board of Fish on what the Central Kenai Peninsula would like to see them do. And certainly that is an important process. It's interesting as we take a look at the fishery this year and what happened with the fishery. I think when you look at data that managers do have, they look at some very important numbers to manage our fishery here, especially pertaining to the sockeye fishery. The number one data that they look at is the forecast, and they're basing that off of out-migration of smolt and different age classes of fish that they expect to come back based on what's come back in the previous year. In season, the data that they're looking at is a piece of data called the OTF, or the Offshore Test Fishery. And that is a snapshot of a sample of what is coming across a line that goes west from Anchor Point. And that happens every day in July except the 31st. And they are taking a snapshot for 30 minutes with a gill net for what kind of fish is in that area right then. And they do that at six stations. And that gives managers a little bit of an idea of what kind of numbers of fish are entering the inlet from the Gulf of Alaska. And it's important to recognize that that number is then normed, or we kind of affirm or question that number based on catch data for the drift fishery in the inlet. What happened this year is that Jay So on July 19th, the department made a decision to close the drift fishery because they were concerned with escapement. Now, I've heard from reliable sources that this was not an agreed-upon decision by all parties. The governor spoke about needing to make sure that people that were closest to the resource were managing the fishery, and I assume that that meant local managers. And it's my understanding that that was not how this decision was made on July 19th, and so or for the fishery on July 19th. So that's concerning, especially when you have one area manager who has a lot of experience in the fishery, and if his institutional knowledge was not heeded in this manner, that's concerning. So why does that matter? Why does it matter that the drift fishery was closed on the 19th, and why did it impact the rest of the season? So if the drift fishery is able to fish on the 19th, that catch data can norm what's been coming in the OTF, the Offshore Test Fishery Index. And based on that, excuse me for a minute, managers will be able to know, hey, we don't have as many fish in the inlet as we thought we did. Or maybe there's more. But in this case, it was likely that the main push of fish that you saw on the counter of a 60,000 passage on the counter on the 21st would have been clear of most of the nets, certainly in the central inlet, and have been in the river. However, you didn't have that data. So we don't have catch data to go by. And Paul mentioned earlier about sharing the burden of conservation. At that point, almost a week earlier than action was taken by the department, you would have catch data to say, hey, we have a lot less fish than we thought we were going to have. And then you have the ability for all user groups to share in the burden of conservation and not just one. And I think that's important. So it's frustrating when not only are we facing misinformation from self-interested parties, we're facing folks who kind of feel maybe a little bit of pressure from certain self-interested parties to make sure that they are politically protected. Now, in the meeting, I used that term political, and that gets political when you use that word political. And maybe I should have been more direct in my question there. But I think that, you know, if you listen to the institutional knowledge and figure out why the department has done what it does in the past and why that's valuable, you have a much better ability to manage the fishery based on the data that you have.
I wrote a story about that meeting, and Jesse gave me a call yesterday. I had misinterpreted something. Escapement goals. I always thought escapement goals were number of fish past the counter, but escapement goals, I realize, is more than just the number of fish, isn't it? Right.
Well, in my interpretation, it is. It is a goal. It is the number of fish, but it incorporates different factors depending on what type of management goal the Department of Fish and Game has promoted and the Board of Fish has decided on. Something clearly, yeah, the maximum sustained yield, sustainable escapement goals, biological escapement goals are the full control of the Department of Fish and Game. The Board of Fisheries does not have the authority to tell the Department of Fish and Game that their escapement goal is wrong. So that is the full responsibility of the department. But what the Board of Fish can do is use an optimal escapement goal, which is a offshoot of the federal optimum escapement goal. And in that, our optimum sustained yield, which allows the Board of Fish to consider social issues. Clearly, the makeup of the board and the individual's view on life and resources comes into play when these optimal escapement goals are adopted. The Department of Fish and Game can't say no to them. The only thing they can say is, well, if you said that, you know, we could produce 3,000 and we need 3,000 for a maximum sustained yield for any particular salmon species, and the departments, I mean, and the Board of Fish says, well, no, really, it should be just 2,000. They can't do that. So clearly, there's some full different responsibilities of both. The department one requires them to reevaluate escapement goals. But one thing the commissioner did say at the meeting, and then after the meeting was over, was he was considering having some kind of meeting to discuss escapement goals in general. And I would imagine it would be an invite of individual interests, and the department would be, I'm sure, would be integral with it. But clearly, just like when we're using our Google to find our way, we go through a recalculating mode on a regular basis. In maybe these escapement goals aren't clearly sufficient to be able to manage for a downturn in the escapement or a radical nature of having so many fish return or over escapement, which creates very irregular returns, erratic returns. Statistically, there's documentation that shows that if you continually overscape, that you're going to have some very poor years and some very good years, but not normal years. And that's what maximum sustained yield range does. It gives you a low point and a high point for the best statistical guess of how you can return within that range on a yearly basis. That is what the Department of Fish and Game is mandated to do, is return fish in a maximum sustained yield. Without sufficient information, they will say that it's a sustained escapement goal. And that still tries to encompass as much knowledge as possible to bring as many fish back on a continuous basis within a range. The OEG sets that different. And I think it's very, very important that we go through this exercise to just realize what's going on and how user groups are being affected. All user groups are affected this year. This is not just a commercial fisheries issue. This is a detriment to all the other users, the personal use users, the sport fish users, all the industry that's related to both. And on the community as in its close nature, and the community as a whole is the state of Alaska. So by changing these goals, by not having consistent returns, we set the apple cart off. And in right now, in our economic status in the state, well, I don't think we can really afford this. And this is happening all over the entire state. Another little thing about weak stock management is for 20 years, some advocates in the sport fishing industry have promoting weak stock management. What weak stock management is that if everything isn't clearly within the goals, either mandated by the department or implemented by the Board of Fisheries, then all other opportunities go away. All other opportunities. The switch goes off. And something is inherently wrong with a system that closes all the other opportunities off because of one status or one number that may or may not be accurate for appropriate for the time that we live in now.
Well, I'm going to ask you this because I'm not clear on it. I think one of the things Jay was getting might have been getting at was the escapement goal contains more than just getting fish in the river. So is harvest, I should know this, but I'm showing my ignorance here. Harvest is worked into the escapement goal. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. In the sonar at mile 19 for sockeye, let's say, anything that's harvested above that in the legal areas, Tuskelak Lake, there is an estimate to how many of those fish are caught, and that is incorporated into the optimal escapement goal.
Okay, so I've seen comments and heard people say, well, let's just get the fish up the river. Nobody fishes until we get the minimum escapement, and then everybody can go. And it's when people say that, I just say, please educate yourself on how this works. It's not a matter of just reaching the deadline, you know, reaching the finish line with a certain number of fish and then go wide open. They try to spread the return, you know, across the span of the summer, and people are allowed to harvest, they're monitoring the progress toward that goal. But it's not as cut and dried as just hitting a number. So I think that's an important thing that people in the community don't understand. And it needs to be, you know, that's, you know, the department can only do so much. They're facing the cuts that everybody else is. But getting good information out there, again, I think is key to people understanding this. And just to clarify something Paul was saying, when he was talking about weak stock management specifically, if the king numbers, you know, early on there was some concern over kings. If the department right now, the way the regulations are written, if the department doesn't project to meet the minimum escapement of king salmon and they take the action of ending sport fishing on king salmon in the Kenai, the set net fishery stops, period, even though we don't fish primarily for kings. And that sets the system up to be over-escaped. It happened, you know, what you do is you sacrifice, you not only stop, you know, you're trying to protect this one run, but you're essentially setting the other one up for failure if you continue to over-escape, which has happened for darn near a decade on both rivers. And I can't help but wonder if what we're seeing now is the result of that. And there's a very active effort to say over-escapement doesn't matter. And, again, it's misinformation that has gotten a foothold, unfortunately.
So, Andy and Paul, could you guys speak to that a little bit more under this premise? You know, I think everybody wants the most fish possible to return to our system, to Upper Cook Inlet and to all of our area streams and rivers. You know, everybody wants that to be sustainable. I believe the science has shown that we can't continue to put millions and millions of fish in the Kenai River and hundreds of thousands of fish in the Kusilov River and have that be sustainable. Andy and Paul, could you guys talk a little bit more about that science of maximum sustainable yield and how harvest really allows the most fish to come back reliably every year for all user groups to utilize?
I'm going to suggest I speak first because I think Paul has a deeper understanding of this. I tend to have these broader thoughts on how this works, and I've really tried to put myself in the place of, say, a sport fisherman or a sport fishing guide. And they're not necessarily, you know, I am a commercial fisherman, so take this with a grain of salt, but say you have 1 cubic yard of water in the Kenai River. If you have 10 fish in that cubic yard of water, the likelihood of you catching a fish on a hook, because sockeye don't really, you know, they call it flossing, but you're essentially snagging a fish in the mouth. They're not necessarily biting those fish or those flies or their lures. But you're going to have higher likelihood to catch a fish if you've got 10 fish in that cubic yard of water. But you won't catch all of them. You'll catch a small number of them, but it will be good fishing. But a lot of fish will make it past them and will spawn, and it will exceed the carrying capacity of the river. And so when you look at the charts, you know, there's a point when putting more fish onto the spawning beds starts to diminish the amount of fish who survive. From a commercial perspective, I'd like to see a reasonable amount of fish in that cubic square yard of water, enough for good sport fishing, but, you know, maybe it's going to take 4 casts instead of 2 or 10 instead of 1. I don't know. But to not exceed the upper end when these fish get up to the top where they spawn, when they don't get caught and they, you know, not only do they damage the river, but it's foregone harvest. It's money that isn't being made by people who can take those fish and put that money into the economy. It's fish, you know, that are not fed to people. You know, one of the factors that gets thrown around a lot is, claim is, you know, you know, there are very few commercial fishermen relative to sport fishermen, and we're getting all these fish. Well, we're harvesting those fish and we're putting them into the economy. It's a little bit like saying, well, there's only so many oil workers in Alaska and they're getting all the oil. Well, the oil harvest is going into the economy. We're not taking those fish and using them personally. We're putting them into the system. We're feeding canneries, you know, which are feeding people all over the world. You know, and frankly, Cook Inlet fish on a normal year largely feeds the fresh market, which is fairly local. You know, it's Anchorage and Pacific Northwest. But I think that I'm rambling again, but MSY means different things to different people. So to maximize the return for a sport fisherman or a sport fishing guide means, or a dip netter, means something different than it does to a commercial fisherman. And that's probably one of the big sticking points in when, you know, when people look at why managers manage the way that they do. I think it's, you know, it's whether we agree to the end goal, and I, you know, clearly we don't. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you, Andy. I'll try to answer that and not get too far into the technical aspects of it. Mind you, you know, the maximum sustained yield is based on science that was developed in the 50s and 60s. Basically, it's we relate to it as the Ricker curve. And when you look at these curves, there's a midpoint, not really a midpoint. It could be right of center most of the time. But it's not a perfect bell shape. It's in fact, it's gradual on the left side of that point, that MSY point. And on the right side, it drops off rather quickly. And what that means is that if you exceed or the top end of the goal, or you're in that top portion of the goal from the midpoint, there is a serious reason that you will not return a one-to-one ratio of salmon. I mean, all fisheries managers are looking to return more than a one-to-one, but that's their minimum goal, is whatever goes in, hopefully they're going to get something in return at that same number. So when we talk about over-escapement, we're really talking about a statistical analysis that's been tried and true for decades now that says that if you continue to put too many of the salmon in a particular watershed, then you have a high degree of chance of having a less than one-to-one return spawner. And, you know, when you're looking at the high point of it, you're looking at two, three, four spawners return for a, excuse me, for a fish return for every spawner. That's great. That sounds good to all of us. And that's what all that MSY range and goals are. And that's why the idea of exceeding the top end of the maximum sustained yield is so dangerous. And if you think of it this way, the mandate by the department is to go through and return the run over a range of time. And you consider this. It's not, you know, all the fish aren't going to one creek to spawn. And if that was the case, it would be easier to manage, but it's not. You have a myriad of different creeks and rivers and tributaries and feeders that these salmon, in particular sockeye salmon, are spawning in. Only so many can get in there. If you ever have a chance to go to the Kosilof River, you'll see, and the Tustamina Lake, you'll see that many of the streams, because of different climatic conditions or whatever, there's not enough spawning area for those salmon to go into. So studies have shown that 50% of those returning sockeye into the Tustamina will spawn in the lake area, the near zone lake area, or the areas where the mouth of the creeks are. Do they survive at a high ratio? Probably not. Those that are in the creeks and systems survive higher. So you want to be able to return the fish in such a manner that they have abilities, these salmon, to go into these systems and spawn without having their reds dug up, without having distribution, without having oxygen problems. And then you look at another factor, it's called rearing. And rearing is extremely important in the sense that if there's not enough sufficient nutrients, light penetration, phosphorus, and things like that, there's not enough microorganisms for small salmon fry to feed on. And if you have competition in that area, you got a lot of skinny fish leaving, and a lot of skinny fish don't survive tough conditions in the ocean.
Yeah, that's true. Did you have something else to add about that, Jesse?
Sure. Okay. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it. Yeah, and in talking about maximum sustainable yield, I think it's important to talk about fishing opportunity and what that looks like. And, you know, I spent a couple of days sport fishing this week already and plan to do some more as we wrap up. And it doesn't look like we'll be commercial fishing anytime soon. And I enjoy sport fishing with my family. But here are my experiences with sport fishing so far this week. I fished the Kasila off on Saturday afternoon and went down there. And in the mid-morning, I guess, through afternoon, went down there. And as I was walking down the trail, there were people walking up the trail to meet me that had finished fishing, and they were coming back with limits. And I was, oh, that's great, you know, that's great. Some people are finding some success. We'll likely see some fish down there. And we got set up and started fishing. And in 15 minutes, I caught a fish. It's like, oh, that's really good. Okay, probably will catch some more. And I fished for 2 hours and didn't catch another fish. So what was my experience and opportunity in fishing? I missed the pulse of fish that went by on that portion of the river for that period of time. And I think the expectation of people has become, oh, this is Alaska, this is Kenai Peninsula, this is the Kenai Peninsula, and every time we go fishing, we should get a limit. And if we don't get a limit, now it's become that it's someone else's fault. Now it's become, oh, I didn't get my limit because I was fishing, and my expectation was not fishing but actually catching, and now I need to talk to a legislator, or I need to complain to my guide service, right? I need to demand action that I haven't had my expectations met as a sport fisherman. I think that's a dangerous place to be. I think that's a dangerous place to be for the sport of fishing, as you would call it, angling in many of the more purist form. But, you know, I think as commercial fishermen, we've come to know that through the years, and I'm certainly sure that Paul and Andy can talk about slow days in commercial fishing. I know that there have been many days where I've sat out on my commercial fishing boat with 300 yards of gill net and know that I could have caught many more fish on a hook and line in the river than I've caught all day in a boat with that much net. It might seem hard to believe, but it happens more often than you'd think. So maximum sustainable yield, that principle, Jay, to me it means that we're returning steady returns of salmon to the streams and to the Cook Inlet so that all users have opportunity to fish and so that they all have the opportunity to go and experience what that's like. And if they do that for economic value, whether they are displacing money that they would spend on food in the PU fishery, whether they are making money off a commercial fishery in the river or in the Cook Inlet, that's important. And it's important that those activities be allowed to continue and maximize them in a way that's equitable. And so I think some people's goal is, well, we want to put as many fish in the river so that our user group can benefit. Whereas the people on the other side of the coin, they might have the opposite view. I think that's really dangerous. I think if we look at the science that we have, not some rainbow and unicorn science that says, well, we don't know what the river will do if we just put millions and millions of fish. No, we do. We know. Okay? And we see those crash and boom patterns that happen in game management as well. We know what happens when you overload a system. It crashes. The goal of maximum sustainable yield is to level out the peaks and valleys to return steady returns over the years so that we have what's known as an orderly fishery that can be relied upon. That's good for tourism, that's good for the residents, that's good for people who rely on the fish to eat because they like to eat it and to catch because they like to catch it.
Yeah. I imagine if things got that orderly, you wouldn't be confined to goofy sections of the inlet either.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a different wrinkle, and that's part of the weak stock management that Paul was referring to earlier.
Yeah, I come from Dillingham, And, you know, there's like five sections there, and it's open or it's not. And I never knew of any, like, special little areas until I moved here. It's like, wait, you can't fish right here, but you can fish right there. I don't get it. And, you know, until somebody explained it to me, and, you know, oh, no, they're catching all of Wasilla's fish. You don't want to, we don't want to touch them. So we can't go in this corridor, or they have to be excluded over here. They get to fish around Mount Augustine, or something. I don't know.
Right. So, yeah, and the science based on corridor management, Jay, is a lot to be determined. It was very lacking. The effect that the corridor has on the drift fishery is that it makes the drift fishery much less successful. And in so doing, the drift fishermen catch a lot less of all fish. And so the corridor is an allocation tool in its effects, but whether or not it is better at discriminating against northbound sockeye or northbound coho has yet to be determined on a real strong basis from what I've seen.
Let me ask you guys about pink salmon. I remember when I first moved here about 20 years ago, I went out with some friends. We went fishing for silvers. And, you know, we caught a couple of silvers, but there were literally hundreds of humpies jumping all around us on the Kenai River. And I thought, well, aren't the commercial guys out here catching all these humpies? You know, keep them from fouling my hook when I want a tasty silver? And my buddy said, no, they don't fish pinks in the inlet here because they might catch silvers. Is that the deal? Anybody?
Well, we do have a pink salmon plan in place, and we talked to the governor about that. You know, the governor was very open, promised to listen and get back to us, and he took extensive notes. Those are the opportunities I was talking about earlier. The last session the board had in 2017 now, I can't remember how many Board of Fish members meetings I've gone to. But clearly, the board adjusted the opportunities to allow more harvest on the pink salmon in the last week of our regular season, set net season, which is the 7th or 8th through 15th. And so in that aspect, yeah, we're very interested, and so is the drift fleet as well. It doesn't pay as much, but it's an opportunity. It's a reasonable opportunity, and we have a realistic expectation of gaining economic gain for that, and that's good for the community. So yeah, we are very much interested in it, but the way that the weak stock management system goes, or the way the Board of Fish looks at it, it's just, well, whatever is loudest or whoever speaks loudest in our ear, then that's how we will manage it for, regardless of the other user who is who's out there ready and willing to harvest whatever is surplus to the needs of escapement.
Huh. Well, what are you going to do? You know, the Board of Fish is meeting here in town next year, right? Or the year
2020, I believe. 2020. Is that correct, Paul?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I remember when they met down at the Soldotna Sports Center. I guess it was like 20 years ago. But it was supposed to be like a 4-day meeting or 5-day meeting. It went 17 days, I think. Mm. And I sat in there. I got a sore butt. And you know what? I think that meeting, it really seemed like that was the meeting that a certain land baron in Anchorage really got his way over the Kenai River at that meeting. I mean, it just seemed to be they were plugged in.
Well, clearly, there's no secret that Mr. Bob Penny has been very active in promoting sports fishing and was very instrumental in forming Kenai River Sports Fishing Association. I think there's two companies there, and I'm not speaking for them. And obviously, you know, he had concerns, and the public, if his concerns weren't valid, the public wouldn't be there as well supporting it. So we understand that. We understand there's other user groups and other interest groups that are promoting those interests. It's a little difficult when influence from individuals affect management for all of us in such a manner that it doesn't appear to be equitable and fair. So that's what the Board of Fish does, is deal with allocation. And clearly, whoever are the members, as I said earlier today, determines and predominates the type of management plans and the adjustments to those plans on a 3-year cycle. So in 99, that was a pretty hot meeting. I believe that was 99 or in that time zone. And it was, I think there was Alaska State Troopers in the room, and, you know, and I think some folks didn't particularly like the way Mr. Penny was offering pizzas to everyone, and they didn't particularly like it. So I don't think there was any real extreme need for protection. I think people were expressing their views. But clearly, when people feel that they're being slighted out of the process, when they don't have a proper say or an equal say, when their livelihoods that they have been following for hundreds of years are being threatened and affected, then they do get very, very outspoken. And clearly, that's what's happening now. Some other time, and we'll probably talk about some of the efforts for fleet reduction in Cook Inlet in the SetNet fleet. And that would be a separate subject.
Yeah, they were trying that over in Bristol Bay as well, but I would love to talk to you about that. Any last words here, Andy? We just got Jesse, we got like 1 minute, and then I'll ask Andy on the phone.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. I think it's important for everybody to remember that, you know, commercial fisheries want to partner with our community, and we do contribute a lot to the community as far as jobs and certainly our local monies, and a lot of that money goes back into the community. The lion's share of commercial fishermen are residents, and we are an important part of this community. And it's unfortunate that I hear that, oh, you don't contribute anything to, again, the self-interested folks who want more fish for their interests. And I recognize that all user groups have an important part in our community, and we need to manage the fish honestly with good science so that we can have a maximum sustained yield of fish returning, and an expectation that we have an orderly fishery in a way that can be economically beneficial for our community here on the Kenai Peninsula and all Alaska.
Excellent. Andy, do you have any last words here? You literally have 45 seconds.
Okay. I agree with everything he said. Yeah, we've got to do this together. You know, the number, I can't speak to the drifters, but 85% of set netters are Alaska residents. 85% of those are Kenai Peninsula residents. These are your neighbors. We've never called for the elimination of anybody else. I can only speak for KPFA. The other side has. They've done a number of initiatives. But if you take one component out, we're going to hurt everybody. So I want to work together to come up with some sort of solution. And the governor has convened a group to try to do that. We'll see if that continues. But people are already backing out of it on the sports side, unfortunately. So I'd love to see it go forward, and I hope we can all be together, you know, 50 years from now, continuing to fish these resources.
All right. Well, thank you, Andy Hall, Jesse Borkman, and Paul Shadur for coming in today on the Kenai Conversation, talking all about commercial fishing.